This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham.
You'll meet a Bloomington minister who's helping bridge the gap between law enforcement and black and brown community members, especially at-risk youth.
There's lots of walls that they put up. You're talking with teens that have been hurt a lot or let down a lot.
Andrew Held talks to WGLT student reporter Tiffany Jackson about founding City Life and his new role at Western Avenue Community Center. Eric Stock looks closer at the changing dynamics in the Normal Town Council, plus meet a Bloomington Normal competitive eater who just made it to the big time. That after a GLT news update. This is Sound Ideas on GLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from GLT listeners. Join the community of news consumers who listen to Sound Ideas and are also willing to support it financially. Learn more about listener-supported radio and GLT at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. The town of Normal recently brought in a government strategist to meet privately with the town council and administration. The goal? To help the seven-member body understand the role of a city manager form of government, to help the newly elected council members transition from a mode of campaigning to one of governing, following a campaign in which voters called for a change in direction. As WGLT's Eric Stock reports, 1 month after that retreat, clear divisions remain over the role the elected body is supposed to serve in overseeing how the town's government runs.
Stan Nord and Karen Smith were two of the top three vote-getters from among eight candidates in the April election. As Smith sees it, the two were elected, along with incumbent Kathleen Lorenz, because they wanted to fight the status quo, largely criticizing what they consider to be a lack of fiscal discipline on the council.
Stan and I ran on a different platform and actually were saying that we were proposing to change the way things were. So there are some individuals that still struggle to accept that we are different.
Different in philosophy and sometimes in approach. She and Nord routinely question staff during council meetings about budget items, even after they've already asked and been answered in private. They feel too much of the town's business is done under a cloak of secrecy or is rushed to minimize public input. Smith says she was gratified to see all four items on last week's council omnibus agenda were removed for discussion. Those are the items considered routine and are all voted on together, unless a council member or the mayor ask they be considered separately.
That was one of my frustrations when I was sitting in the audience, that so much of the business didn't get aired while there were people watching. And so it is something that is a style that Scott and I have.
Councilmember Stan Nord says the correct time to raise a budget issue is when it's first identified, rather than waiting for the bureaucratic process to play out on a spending plan that a prior council approved months ago. He does this through a process he calls spot checking, and it often plays out in the council chambers.
Randomly choose places, do a spot check, see how it's working, and if everything comes back fine, great. But this is the last stop before something is approved. So, you know, it is our responsibility to look out for how we are spending taxpayers' money.
Councilmember Kevin McCarthy calls himself a chronic over-preparer. He says when he has questions, he asks staff ahead of time and leaves it at that.
Is it valuable to rehash in public what's already been put out to the public? I suppose I don't always think that some of the choices are worthwhile.
Mayor Chris Koos acknowledges it took himself well over a year to fully understand his role on the council when he was first elected in 2001, but he says he's trying to curtail the council micromanaging administration.
And I think the majority of my fellow council members feel the same way about it, because it is not, you know, it is not our job to get into the day-to-day and pick that apart. That's the city manager's job. And communicating that to the city manager is appropriate, But at the same time, Pam Reese is the person who runs the city day to day, and she makes those decisions, not us. Now, if we are unhappy about it as a majority, we can remove the city manager.
Although ultimately, the council was voting on these things. You know, the council could, as you said, just simply flat out say, no, we're not going to pay this bill because we object to it for some reason. So I guess ultimately, structurally, it does go to council.
Let's talk about the bills, and it's something that'll probably come out. Approving the bills is a matter of transparency. It's been suggested by our auditors. The fact is those bills are already paid. So it's just an acknowledgement that the council is aware of the bills. So the idea of saying we're not going to pay bill X because I don't want to pay it, well, it's already been paid. Again, it's more of a transparency issue, so people see that the council is looking at the bills and is aware of the dollars being spent.
How closely should the council be following each of these bills line by line? I mean, not necessarily to micromanage, but just to see where their tax dollars are going.
Well, and I think it's a fair look, especially if you're a new council member. I had those questions. You know, it's why is the police department have a monthly bill of $35,000 going to MedCom? Well, that's our subscription to MedCom. I think those are fair questions that council members can ask, whether that needs to be done at the table or with a discussion with the city manager or a fellow council member. You know, those are all opportunities to do that. And you know, going back to the bills, in a council in normal by ordinance, every bill under $25,000 is at the discretion of the city manager. She has spending authority up to $25,000 without council approval. Anything over $25,000 has been approved by a council in prior actions.
Do you expect this to be an ongoing issue? Like you said, it took 18 months for you to really fully grasp the scope of the role of a council member. Do you expect this to be an ongoing battle?
I see it diminishing, but Mr. Nord said in the last council meeting that as long as we were renting space in Uptown 1, he would vote against the bills. So in that sense, it's probably going to be ongoing.
Given the fact that two of the top three were running as change agents for the town, I think Nord most boisterously in that direction, does that not give them some additional leeway to go over the budget with a fine-tooth comb, because that's what they were elected to do?
No. It doesn't give them any more authority than any other council member. I've been top vote getter every time I ran. That doesn't give me more power over my fellow council members. You're now one of seven. And not to say that people are ignoring the outcome of that vote and what people were asking for. I will say that's probably a story for another day. There was an incredible amount of misinformation attached to these campaigns. That did influence the vote.
Mayor Chris Cusa would not elaborate on what he described as misinformation. So how much of the strife on the town council can be chalked up to growing pains? At least one council member will allow for some of that.
It's one of those things, when you first come off the campaign trail, sometimes you can still be in that mindset, and sometimes you have to, you know, come down off the cloud, and it's okay.
That's Kimberly Cummings. She was first elected to the town council in 2017. She says the council did take notice of the voters' intentions in the recent election, and she attributes part of the division to the tenor of American politics today. She says that's given rise to vocal opposition.
There's things that we can listen more on from individuals. I think that what we're really seeing is a greater engagement of constituents or the community, I should say, because of what's happening at a national level.
Councilmember Stan Nord admits he's still on a learning curve in his first-time experience in municipal government, but he says he's learning how inflexible government budgeting can be.
If there's an opportunity to save money with a very minor change, the aha piece was that is so difficult in government, in business, or at the kitchen table, if you realize that you've got the opportunity to save some money, you can immediately make the change.
The council can't make any significant changes to the budget until next spring, nearly a full year into Nord and Smith's first term. I'm Eric Stock.
Councilmember Kevin McCarthy says the town builds public trust by making the proposed spending plan available to the public during the budget process and after the council has approved it. McCarthy says he's received very few questions from the public about his 7 years in the council. He says the council is still developing a code of conduct for itself stemming from that early June retreat. This is Sound Ideas.
The news you need when you want it. That's what you'll find at our website, WGLT.org. The latest local news stories, plus reports from Springfield, Washington, and around the world. You can also subscribe to our podcast and catch up on your favorite GLT features, from GLT's Grow to John Norton's music interviews and everything in between. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. An economist predicts the state's recent gas tax increase of 19 cents per gallon will impact how much we drive. Maybe not in the short term, but likely over the next few years. Mike Seaborg is an economics professor at Illinois Wesleyan University. He says that could change how we pay for our roads and bridges in the future and how we address climate change. Seaborg tells WGLT's Eric Stock he, too, was among the many lined up at the gas station last week, hours before the tax went into effect, hoping to save a few bucks.
Just as aggravated, I think, as a lot of others were with the increase in the prices.
Now, the price of gas statewide only went up about 5 cents in the first day, according to Gas Buddy, and it's trickled upward since then. Does that mean that station owners are absorbing the cost temporarily, or are they just looking to gradually do it to avoid that sticker shock?
Yeah. Now, there's a lot of things that affect gas prices. From day to day, but for sure the gas tax is permanent, and at least in the short run, I would expect that to make its way into prices that consumers pay.
How close before the entire 19 cents is passed on to the consumer?
Oh, not long. No. It's a fairly inelastic, what we'd call an inelastic demand relationship, and so that means that the incidence of these kinds of taxes almost always are borne by consumers.
At what point does price fluctuations impact driving habits, whether people drive out of town for the holiday and those types of decisions that people make with their daily lives?
I don't think it's so much the short-term fluctuations, but I think it's if an increase in gas prices is permanent and is sustained for several years, then habits are certainly affected. We saw this back in the 1970s, for instance, and with gas prices going up because of conflicts in the Middle East mostly. And those were fairly long-term increases in price, and consumers made adjustments. We started buying smaller, fuel-efficient cars. The Japanese really benefited from this because they made a lot of those cars and were able to export them to the United States. So the adjustment, if the price increase is sustained, then we can expect adjustments. I think as consumers, we're used to short-run fluctuations in gas prices, and we don't make adjustments that much in the short run.
Well, if you look over the last 10 years, those fluctuations have continued. Gas is cheaper than it has been at times in the past, yeah. But that could be short-lived.
It could be. Yeah, it could be. We could see increases in gas prices, and then I would expect some adjustments. The other thing that's happening at the same time that gas taxes are going up, pushing up gas prices, is that registration fees are going up, and that's kind of an overlooked aspect of all of this.
Because it's a one time, once a year.
It's one time every year, and so if you own two vehicles, then the registration fee on both of those will go up by $50. And so that's roughly a $100 increase in fees, which is a tax, right there. And that'll be roughly equivalent to what you're paying in increased gas taxes. And so the fees sort of double the impact.
That increase would seem harder to avoid unless you're going to trade a vehicle in, get rid of it, sell it, whatever. Maybe not a lot of people are going to do that. They're just going to have to eat it, right?
But some may.
Over the $50 increase?
If you have two cars, let's say, and you're on a low mm-hmm. income, a budget income, I think most drivers in Illinois would drive roughly 12,000 some odd miles per year. Okay, and that would put you into about $100 increase in gas taxes. If you have two vehicles, then you're paying $200 additional in gas taxes, and $100 additional in registration fees, for a total of $300. So that would take quite a hit on a lower income family.
Sure, when you combine those two things.
Yeah, and so it might pay that family then to get rid of the gas guzzler, and to hang on to the more fuel efficient car, and to try to make do.
So because of those considerations, is it plausible to suggest that the increase in the gas tax and the registrations could lead to significant changes in driving habits to the extent that this tax does not generate all the revenue that it is projected and the state is counting on for infrastructure?
Yeah, it could lead to some changes, I think, at the margin, as people who are deliberating on whether to keep that second car are facing the different additional expenses. They get rid of the second car, or maybe shorten your trips a little bit to save on expenses. So there will be some adjustments over time. This is a permanent change in the cost of gasoline, and so we would expect some adjustments at the margin. It also puts the state of Illinois in sort of the unenviable position of having among the highest gas taxes in the United States. I think we rank maybe third right now, third highest. But if cities follow suit and increase like Bloomington has, and increase their gas taxes, then that would probably move us up into the number one or number two position nationally of highest gas taxes.
And I was going to segue into that now here on Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Mike Seaborg, the Robert S. Eckley Distinguished Professor of Economics at Illinois Wesleyan University. As you had alluded to, Bloomington increased its portion of the motor fuel tax by 4 cents, making it 8 cents. Normal did not do that, however. Does that create this double whammy that could impact driving habits here in our community?
Yeah, the Bloomington tax is, as you mentioned, an increase of only 4 cents. The state tax increase is 19 cents. So it does add to the cost of a gallon of gasoline, that's for sure. But it also generates $2.3 million of revenue for the city of Bloomington
annually, which
they can use for much-needed street repair and some improvement, probably.
Now, when the city first talked about this, City Manager Tim Gleason had dismissed concern that drivers would just travel across Division Street to gas up because over time prices would eventually reach parity anyway in the Twin Cities. Is that typically what happens?
Yeah, a 4 cent difference is hardly noticeable, I think, and so it's unlikely that that there'll be a lot of driving across city lines to fill up. There's more of a problem with the state line, where
people in Danville and border communities would more likely go across into Indiana or Kentucky or Missouri.
Or Missouri, where gas prices are quite low right now relative to Illinois. And so you'd expect some of that, but I don't think it would be a major impact statewide, but virtually none in Bloomington and Normal.
If the 4 cent difference is not that much, would we presume then that Normal at some point will take that on and add it?
I think that's a pretty good guess. If Normal is in need of some street repairs and some improvements, then it would be a wise thing to do, I think.
Well, of course, fuel powers so much of our economy. There's hardly a business out there that's not impacted in some way by this. In particular, trucking companies, transit agencies, even Uber, other ride-sharing services. How much do you expect they'll be able to absorb some of this? And ultimately, do we all end up paying for it as customers?
We do all end up paying for it as customers. A major part of the cost of ride sharing, for instance, is fuel costs. It's an important part of the cost of it. Food delivery, especially, which is picking up in popularity now, Also is much affected by the cost of fuel.
And so what are the economic impacts for the state and for us as consumers? We're paying the 19-cent tax additionally for driving to work, driving to school, et cetera. And then there's also this second tax that comes from the companies that we work with because they're not able to pay this entire fare themselves.
That's exactly right. So to the extent that the cost of production of, say, an Uber service goes up, then eventually that'll show up in the fares that we pay.
Governor Pritzker has said that the state's infrastructure has been terribly neglected for a long time. Roads, bridges, so much of that has been underfunded for such a significant period of time. Well, they feel that they'll be able to save money in the long run by having proper maintenance as opposed to going back after the fact, after accidents, after, you know, bridges fail and other sort of a cataclysmic type events that the state has been neglecting.
That's an excellent point. So the positive side of these higher taxes that we're paying for fuel, the positive side, of course, is that they're going into infrastructure improvement. They're going into that $45 billion dollar, what is it called?
The capital bill.
Rebuild Illinois. Rebuild Illinois program. And most of that goes to transportation improvements. And to the extent that we fill those potholes and improve the quality of roads and bridges, especially, we're going to have fewer repairs on cars, fewer bursted tires and problems like that.
Well, what do you feel about the economic case that the governor has made on this? That yes, we're all going to pay a little more, but it's going to put us ahead in the long run.
I think it's a good case, and we're sorely in need of infrastructure improvements. That's for sure. You just all you have to do is drive on Illinois roads, and then drive in other states, and you can see you can feel the differences.
Because of the emergence of electric vehicles and hybrid vehicles and those that are meant to cost less to fuel, there's been talk in Springfield of moving to a miles-driven format to determine how much taxes you pay. That would involve everyone getting a tracking device that can monitor their mileage. And aside from Big Brother reservations about that, if that were to happen, what kind of impact might that have in terms of people's driving habits?
Well, it could have an impact. There are other ways, though, of incentivizing less driving, and one of them is the tax itself. And there's been a lot of talk within the economics profession about a carbon tax generally as a way of dealing with global warming and climate change. So in an instance at the micro level, that's what we're seeing is sort of a carbon tax, a tax on gasoline, which should cause us to drive somewhat more conservatively because of the higher gas prices. I think the monitoring idea is a lot more bureaucratic. It's going to require a lot more expense than say the straight tax, and probably will have a similar effect.
That was Illinois Wesleyan University economics professor Mike Seaborg with WGLT's Eric Stock. This is Sound Ideas.
How much control do you think you have over the decisions you make? Probably a lot less than you think.
Every time you open Twitter or Facebook, you're waiting for that DOPA hit. And these algorithms are totally focused on how they biomechanically addict you.
Digital manipulation, that's next time on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Sundays at 10 a.m. on GLT, News and Ideas.
Follow GLT News at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. GLT's award-winning online presence brings you news when it happens, day and night and on weekends. Join the community of users ready to discuss GLT's thoughtful, in-depth reporting and breaking news. Recognized by the Illinois Associated Press for best digital presence, this is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Ryan Denham. When you ask local prosecutors or police to point to a successful example of youth outreach for at-risk kids, the name Andrew Held often comes up. Held is the director of City Life Bloomington, a youth ministry based on Bloomington's west side. WGLT student reporter Tiffany Jackson spoke to Held about what led him to youth outreach work and his new job as interim director at the Western Avenue Community Center.
I think one of the biggest catalysts for doing what we do was a while ago, a couple years ago, at the Jesus House. The city was there. It was a neighborhood kind of meeting to discuss the youth that were in our neighborhood. And we had just got finished with the meeting. We're talking with leadership about getting ice cream, and a couple shots rang out. And Antoine Smith was shot in his shoulder and shot in his face. And we had tended to him, sat down, prayed with him, and his son was actually one of the kids that we were volunteering with at the Jesus House. And so that was a huge catalyst for us. And then it was only, I believe, 2 weeks later, having a Bible study, and I was outside talking to a member of the Jesus House, and a guy came running up Allen Street and started shooting at a group of teens. And so there was moms of strollers that were running all over the place. And so it was after those two big events that we really buckled down and said, this is going to be our main focus.
So what is City Life?
So City Life is, it's a ministry model of Youth for Christ. And so we are geared towards 11 to 19 year olds that are at risk. It's urban settings. And our goal is to engage them in authentic Christ-sharing relationships. And so that means we support them in spirituality. We support them with civil success, education, basic health and safety. We want to live and walk life with them. And so if that means going to football games, we're going to football games. Or tutoring, then we're going to tutor. It means a lot of different various services and time spent.
Being in this position, I'm sure that you've met many kids of different backgrounds and beliefs. Are there any obstacles you face when it comes to gaining their trust, and even when it comes to introducing them to a new religion?
Yes. So there's many obstacles. First is this. The goal is we want to get to know them. And so that can take a while. There's lots of walls that they put up. You're talking with teens that have been hurt a lot or let down a lot. So that's why we really are big on consistency and really being committed to these teens. Today, there's a huge wave of teens that have a lot of apathy. And so that is hard when you're trying to engage with them and trying to get them motivated in life, for jobs, for all sorts of different things, to get them excited and just to be a part of something. So that's probably the biggest obstacle, is that.
So your wife speaks highly of you. She says that you are a father figure to a lot of boys in the area. You've taken a lot of them under your wing, and she's even compared it to having your own football team. Is this true? And what are those relationships like?
Yeah, so there are quite a few teens that come to the house and eat all of our food and spend a lot of time with us. And we do. We love them as best as we can, and so we support them, and they do become almost like your own when they're at the house a lot and you're watching them graduate, or you're at their football games or soccer games, and you're pouring so much into their lives, and they're pouring into you as much. And when they open up and share their dreams, their struggles, you do form that bond. And so we are close, and that's the goal, is to not be surfacey, but to really build the relationship. So we do have quite a lot of awesome young men in our lives, yes.
In terms of community, we have a lot of people out here who speak highly of you. A lot of people say that you are a great person who's a prime example of how to bridge the gap between the law enforcement and black and brown kids. So how do you do it, and what inspired you to become that stepping stone towards bridging that gap?
A lot of it was just having to see the police as human beings, and not allowing, I believe that the culture and the new, it influences us way too much, and people don't tend to really think about context and where they are all the time. And so part of the problem that just really bothered me was we'd be at Friendship Park, we'd be working with kids, and I'd have an 8-year-old that would be saying, F the police. And so that's a learned behavior. Now, granted, he may have seen an issue where maybe somebody got arrested or I can't speak to everything, but I do believe for us as kind of Black culture, which, yes, there have been some negative things in the past, but that's not every single police officer. And so I started reaching out to our police department. I believe it was Sarah Mayer, a few other great officers in the very beginning. Assistant Chief Bays actually came out before he was assistant chief, so he would actually come and meet the kids. And we just started building the relationship there. And so we wanted the officers to continue coming so the kids could see the officers as human beings that are there to protect and serve and let our kids know they're not trying to, or they don't want to send you to jail. If you look at almost 99% of the time, police are there, they want to talk through the situation, they want to work it out.
A lot of people who have had those traumatizing things happen to them between the police, how do you take their perspective from remembering those negative things and making them want to bridge that?
Right. I think, yes. And right, yeah. I definitely want to be clear in saying that we don't want to wave those experiences off. And yes, it could be traumatizing. There could be certain experience that is traumatizing. But for me personally, this is what I've learned. So prior to Christ, I had some experiences with the police, okay? Those weren't always the best and always that positive. I'm going to say almost 100% of the time, that was my fault from the way that I was acting and the way that I was mouthing off. Now, that doesn't give anyone else the right to act inappropriate, but if I look at my case and what I was doing, it was mostly me. Because now that I have changed my life and I'm out and about all the time, I haven't had an instance of any police officers, any negative encounters. So I want to look at that and say, all right, how much is my actions? But that's not for every case, though. There could be cases where someone does experience trauma. So I just want to look at it through a true context, though, because we do have just a skewed view, and I was a part of it prior to Christ, where it was just forget the police, and it was just you're threatening me, and you're doing that. It's always that you're holding me down. We just had that mindset, and that's not always the case. So there is that, and I want to make sure I step through this methodically, and that we're clear. And then there's cases where there is where something could happen that or may have happened that has traumatized somebody. And we certainly also want to look at that and just look at that and go, man, that shouldn't have happened. How do we get better? How do we get maybe some better training and just some thoughts? But we also have to understand, too, that people have bad days. And so what I don't see the kind of the right balance all the time is people are rude to me at the church, right? But I don't really go out and saying the whole church is bad. Like, people have bad days. So some experiences where a cop may have yelled at you or cussed you out is a bad day. Now, for you, you expect that officer to act completely fine. He's supposed to be polite every day. I don't see how, because everyone has bad days no matter what jobs they do. So, and they are high stress jobs. Their jobs are not easy. Their jobs are hard. Their jobs are tough. And yes, and the mantra is, oh, they need better training and training and training. Well, they can go through training and training and training, but training doesn't necessarily help relieve stress and those kinds of things. So you're bound to have a bad day. So I think we got to look at that. Did that officer have a bad day? There's many, many factors. What I don't see, from my opinion, is our Bloomington Police Department out really causing lots of traumatic experiences, but I don't have all the information on that, so I can't speak to that. So we just have to be mindful about both sides of everything. Take those who are traumatized. How do we do better as a community, police department? How do we do better? How do we engage people better? How do we kind of get over that, you know, there's always that stigma that they may feel threatened because they're not around people that are same race, same color, and so may feel more agitated, or it could be scared or nervous, right? So how did we get around that?
Being the bridge to that gap between those two relationships, it has to be a lot of pressure, especially when you have those kids who are, like, you know, feeling like F the police and stuff mm-hmm. like that, versus those kids who are more open. So how do you maintain credibility with keeping their trust with also, you know, working with the police and maintaining authority with that?
We try to get the police to come to events, our state's attorney, awesome guy, Don Knapp, organized an event where we took our teens to Mass VR. He was there, Carla Barnes was there, Chief from Normal Police was there, and there was a few officers from there, and Chief Wheeler from Bloomington was there with a couple other officers, like John, our hilarious Facebook police officer, and Nick Jones, and a few other officers. And so they played games together, they interacted. And so we tried to get them to say that, yes, we're working with the police, but most of it is to help you. We're not, I'm not in the back office collecting information with the police, which again is our bad thoughts and how we're not taking it in concept or in the right context. We're, oh, he's working with the police. Why is the first thing, like, it automatically goes to like CI kind of, or snitch mode right there? And it shouldn't. It's just, hey, we're working and we want to collaborate with our city officials and our city members and community members. We have kids that may want to be police officers or can serve in many different ways. So we're just open and honest. And I tell them, look, you need to talk with the officers, engage them, and have shared experiences. So I haven't had anyone feel threatened by that. You know, and I hope they wouldn't. Our goal is to, and I know the police department's goal is not to just, they don't want to lock up our teens. That is not their goal. That is the last resort. They truly want help for the teens. And so hopefully we could be a tool used in that before teens start breaking the law or making mistakes, that we can be a support system to help guide them so they don't get locked up. And that's the biggest goal, I think, for us, is in that we are actually there for the kids, and the partnership with the police really helps.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Tiffany Jackson. I'm in the studio with Andrew Held, pastor of City Life Bloomington, and now the newly named interim executive director at Western Avenue Community Center. The position at Western Avenue Community Center, how did that come about, and why do you want to do it?
So Western Avenue has graciously partnered with us as City Life, and that's one of our goals as City Life, is to partner with a community center. And so it worked out. Amy Cattone really opened up the doors for us and the board as well. And so there's so much history to that community center. I talked to a lot of guys that are my age and older, a lot of people from the neighborhood and even outside, that they always say things like, I used to go to Western Avenue and I did this program there, or I boxed there with Junior. You know, Junior's our local boxing legend. And so there's a lot of rich history there, right? Almost at 93 years old, serving that community. And so we came in as City Life, we used the facility. It's a perfect location for where the kids that we want to serve, and that tight neighborhood focus. And so I came on as a board member just to help serve Western Avenue and to help in that way. And then I happened to leave kind of that role and enter into an assistant director role, just to kind of help update some things and work on some systems and kind of help Amy Cattone out. And then it turned out that Amy Cattone is resigning, so it kind of threw me off for a bit. But I want Western Avenue to succeed and to continue to be a place in West Bloomington where teens can come to and the community can come to for, again, just love and support. I guess one of the biggest frustrations that I have is that we have a lot of services, whether it's churches or any other programs, that the land outside of West Bloomington further east is cheaper. And so people continue to move out of the areas that need the most support. And We don't want to do that. We want to move in. We want people to move in. And so we want Western Avenue to succeed and to be a consistent landmark that people can come to.
So as the new executive director of Western Avenue Community Center, are you going to continue at City Life or take a break from it, or are you just going to juggle both of them?
Yeah, so right now there are no plans to leave City Life. I'm going to continue in doing that. A lot of my hopes for the community center would to really have a high focus for that age range, 11 to 19, and even younger. Because you do want to catch, if you can get a kid from kindergarten, like our after school program goes, you know, from kindergarten to fifth grade. If we can walk with a kid from kindergarten to 19, that's a huge win for us, because that's a lot of positive influences that are in his life. So I really want to push our focus on 11 and 19 year olds, even younger kids. And so I think the two can go together right now well. And then if it doesn't, then that'll be a different story. But for right now, I believe that we can move forward into the future with really focusing on our teens and our young people. And there'll be services for everyone, our seniors, our Hispanic outreach. None of that's going anywhere. But we there's a real high need right now for our youth.
That's City Life Bloomington Director Andrew Held with WGLT student reporter Tiffany Jackson. He was recently named Interim Executive Director at the Western Avenue Community Center. This is Sound Ideas. Joey Chestnut and his eating prowess have helped make the annual 4th of July Nathan's Famous annual hot dog eating contest on Long Island an international cultural event. One of the competitors who Chestnut vanquished last week was a Bloomington man who's relatively new to competitive eating, but can put away hot dogs with the best of them. Matt Hungry Hazard is 25 and works as a consultant in information security. He ate a personal best 34 hot dogs to finish 7th among 18 competitors. Hazard tells WGLT. He's Eric Stock. He has quite the appetite for competition and, of course, food.
I've been watching like the Man versus Food challenges on TV and YouTube, where you eat this giant burger, this big pizza, and you get it for free and you eat like a t-shirt or something like that. So I gave a couple of those a shot and I was able to complete them successfully and started to think, okay, I might be okay at this. And my friends were prompting me to try out for the hot dog eating contest on TV, the big one everyone always talks about. So I was like, okay, I can't eat 74 hot dogs. I don't think I can do it. But they're like, no. You just have to eat like 20-something. You can potentially qualify. So that's kind of what I did. And I did a contest, signed up for a qualifier. I actually didn't win my first one, but it just hooked me. I'm a competitive guy, and I like to eat, so it's just a lot of fun.
So you said that your friends were encouraging you. What did most of your friends and family think about you getting into this line of competition?
They think it's pretty cool in terms of, like, it's just something you don't see every day. It's something not everyone can do, and it's kind of like a sense of amazement there. But it's also just fun to, like, travel. So like my friends would come with me to the restaurant and they're like bragging on me and stuff. I think they enjoyed that, but it's a fun experience. Everyone just gets a little bit of thrill out of it. So yeah, my parents and my family and my friends, they always root me on.
Well, these competitions are certainly about more than just shoveling food in your mouth. There is a strategy to it. So what is your strategy in these competitions and how did you come up with one?
My strategy is to take two of the hot dogs, take them, remove them from the buns and eat those together. And then while eating those, I will dunk the buns into hot water, cherry Kool-Aid, and raspberry lemonade to soak up the buns and then use that as my drink, so to speak, as eating the hot dogs. Came up with that from just watching some of the best do it on YouTube and different videos. So like watching what Joey Chestnut does, watching what Matt Stoney does, some of those other guys. And I switched the drink flavor, so the cherry Kool-Aid and the raspberry lemonade, just because after a while, you start to get tired of the flavor, no matter what it is. Even if it was the best tasting thing in the world at the start, once you get about 3 or 4 pounds in, it's not going to taste so great. So it's just kind of help mute the flavor and allow me to keep going.
How do you train for a competition?
I will make up a bunch of hot dogs at home and eat them just like I would at a contest. And then outside of that, I will drink large volumes of water in a very short period of time just to help stretch the stomach and then not eat a bunch of calories.
And I feel like I have to ask this, are you generally able to keep it down, and was that a challenge at first?
At first, it was not really a challenge at all, because when you're talking, like, talking 5-6 pounds of food, I know it sounds like a lot to a majority of people, but for a competitive eater, that's not, like, a huge amount. So that wasn't, it wouldn't sit very well, but it would stay down. I think the first time I ever got sick after a contest was a mutton sandwich eating contest, and it was just the spiciness of the barbecue. It was like chopped barbecue sliders. Like, no matter how hard I tried, that just did not want to stay down. I just think the spices or whatever. So I think it just depends on the food. But getting sick is never the ideal situation.
And this is Sound Ideas. I'm Eric Stock with Matt Hazard of Normal, a competitive eater, one of 18 contestants at the Nathan's 4th of July hot dog eating contest on Long Island last week. And you set a new personal best with 34 hot dogs consumed. And Joey Chestnut won his 12th annual competition. There he ate 71 hot dogs in the competition, just three short of his record that he set last year. And I think most of us are mystified and possibly amused to what Joey Chestnut can do. As someone who has competed against him and as someone who has an understanding of what it takes, how do you describe what Joey Chestnut can do eating 74 hot dogs in one competition?
Yeah, it's really astounding. He's a very competitive guy, and his competitive drive has been channeled solely into competitive eating. This is his full-time job. It's what he trains for year round, especially that contest. And he was actually, I was riding the bus with him back to the hotel afterwards. He was actually disappointed a little bit in his performance. He's hitting well over the world record mark in practice before. So I think he was a bit disappointed there. But it really is just astounding how fast he can eat food and how much he can eat. He wins a lot of contests throughout the year and usually breaks the world record. So he's just a... He's like the Michael Jordan of competitive eating, or the Tiger Woods.
Yeah, and when Takeru Kobayashi first burst on the scene as this diminutive figure who was able to down these hot dogs at an alarming rate and sort of became a top competitor to Chestnut before Chestnut overtook him, it seemed to change our perception of competitive eaters. Until then, I think we imagined competitive eaters as heavy set, big stomachs, big appetite. And you're a pretty svelte figure yourself, 6'2", 188 pounds. How does body type play a part in how good a competitive eater you can be, or does it?
It plays a factor a little bit. So there's this theory out there called the belt of fat theory, where if you have a lot of body fat in your midsection, that's going to take up room where your stomach could otherwise expand. So a lot of the competitive eaters have a very low body fat percentage. Like even Joey Chestnut, he's not necessarily muscular or that, but he's definitely has a low body fat percentage, is a pretty slim. And a lot of the competitive eaters out there, and especially the ones that are on stage on the 4th of July, I would say 16 or 17 of the 18 people that were out there were really fit and in shape.
Now, were you surprised to come upon this realization as you moved along in competitive eating? Did that change your perceptions at all?
Not necessarily. I just enjoy working out, so I would look like this regardless of whether I was doing competitive eating or not. So it didn't really affect me too much. I know there are some other eaters out there who have lost weight and it's improved their numbers. So that's kind of one of the things to keep in mind.
And how does this play a part of your overall diet? Do you have to make any other restrictions or concessions the rest of the time when you're not in competition to stay a certain weight?
Yep. So I'll eat healthy 90% of the time. And usually before a contest, I'm fasting and going all liquids, like protein shakes, fruit juices, and things of that nature, like 36 hours out before a contest. So I'm already in a calorie deficit heading into the contest, and then one contest will tide you over for a day. You're pretty full usually after that. I might get like a milkshake or something afterwards just to kind of celebrate the occasion. But typically, I just cut my calories throughout the rest of the week.
Do you have a certain number that you have to stay within?
It varies. Because I do work out a lot, I spend a lot more calories than the average person, so I can eat over 3,000 calories a day and stay the same weight. That's just how much I burn. So it just varies. I try to keep it around 2,000, 2,500. That usually balances it out.
I'm sure many people are envious of you. As we talk with Matt Hazard of Normal, a competitor at last week's Coney Island, Nathan's famous hot dog eating competition, eating a personal best 34 and finishing in seventh place. So what do you eat when you're hungry?
My for a cheat meal or just like normally?
Yeah, what's sort of your go-to?
Oh, I love ice cream. If I could eat it every day, I would.
That was competitive eater Matt Hungry Hazard of Bloomington with WGLT's Eric Stock. Hazard enters about 15 competitions a year. The next one is this Sunday, the Fat Boys Pizza Eating Competition in New Orleans. Whoever can chow down the most 2-foot pizza slices in 10 minutes gets a top prize from a $3,000 pot. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. Our website is also where you can find Sound Ideas interviews and stories with help today from Eric Stock and student reporter Tiffany Jackson. You can subscribe to Sound Ideas on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Stitcher, or NPR One. This is 89.1 GLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.